He is an object. Judaism also stated, man is a non-reality, a subtle idea, an intangible, imperceptible arche. The duality of man was willed by the Creator, and man was called upon to be always aware of his antithetic character. Men should experience ontological dialectics, duality, which are interwoven into his very essence. You ask me, what is man supposed to do? Sometimes to act as man object, sometimes to act as man subject, sometimes to act as a real thing, sometimes to act as an intangible personality. And if you'll ask me, what is the task of the Torah? To teach man how to act on certain occasions as men think, and other occasions as men subject. Let me just see how Yahadus has approached it. Now it is, we are out of the stormy area. If you want, you can fall asleep. Let us see. First distinction between man object and man subject asserts itself in the axiology of the individual. Man object does not understand the individual. The individual self-society, the quest, the existence of the individual is justified by his interrelatedness with his fellow man, with an establishment system. Man subject believes in individual worth, in intrinsic worth of the human being, regardless of his contribution to society, regardless of his accomplishment. Man is a dignified being because he is man. That's what man subject says. Man object says, no, it's not true. Man is a dignified being because he is a genius. He's a producer of goods. He's a creator, but not because of his inwardness, because of his depth dimension. System is the highest authority. The individual was called into existence in order to serve the system. Let us take a look. It's not so simple. Yahadus, on the one hand, spoke of the dignity of the individual, no doubt about it. Of his inner worth and centrality. The individual is the king. He is not subordinated to any caste, system, or establishment. Just on the one hand. He is the one whom HaKadosh Baruch Hu fashioned in his image. And you know how Yahadus sanctions the individual, means man subject. And the Bible told us the story of creation of lonely man, of the emergence of just one individual upon whom God has bestowed his blessings. Not to serve the multitude, but to realize himself. The teleology of the individual, when we read the first chapter of creation, is plain and simple. Where can the telos of the teleology of the individual be found? The purpose in this. Not in somebody outside him, because when Adam was created, there was no one outside him. There was only one man. So the teleology of Adam, of the individual, could have been found in one place only, namely in one place, in man himself. And that's what Chazal said in the Mishnah, Lomo Nivri Adam Yechidi, why was man created alone? Leimaloch kon kaim nafishachas ki mekiyem eim oleh. This is the dignity, the statement, declaration of the dignity of the individual. It's very strange that God demonstrated his love for the individual, for the lonely, abandoned, and forgotten man, not only at the time of creation, but also at another time, namely at another time. At creation, Chazal said, God created man, lonely man, not a class, not a species, not a community, he could have created a community of men. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people. No, not to mankind, but to one man, in order to establish firmly the dignity and the worth of the individual. When did God repeat the same performance? When? Yes, but before. God demonstrated his love for the individual, for the lonely, abandoned, and forgotten man, not only at the time of creation, but also when he willed man to establish a covenantal community. With whom did he establish a covenantal community? With many people, hundreds of people, millions of people? He could have done it. He could have awakened them from their slumber, from their lethargic, idolatrous slumber, and summoned them to reach a covenant with him. He didn't do that. God emphasized time and again that the covenantal society will be formed slowly, piecemeal, not by mass conversion, but by gradual education of children and grandchildren. And again, at Sinai already addressed himself to the community, to 600,000 Jews. But God, very strange, he addressed himself to the community, to 600,000 Jews. But the grammatical form he employed was that of the singular, not of the plural. In other words, God did not address himself to the community. He addressed himself to each individual of the community. In other words, it was worthwhile for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to leave the recesses and the deeps of infinity and transcendence and practice Midas HaTzimtzum, self-contraction, on a small mound in the desert, in order to hand down a set of laws or to teach the Torah to a single Jew. Nachmanides, the Rambam, referring to the singular form of the Decalogue, remarks that a singular form was chosen in order to teach the individual how to resist opposition on the part of society, and that in case of general apostasy, the individual must remain steadfast in his faithful loyalty and abide by the will of God, notwithstanding the fact that the majority of the people has abandoned its commitment. The God-Israel union does not require a community. An individual is good enough. I can count more and more halachas which will establish beyond any doubt that Yehudis believed in the dignity of the individual. I'll leave it out for a minute. But I want to say something which is very characteristic of the Bible, of the Tanakh. Whenever I read the Bible, and I read often the Chumash, I study Chumash and Tanakh very often, the story of our people as it was told by the prophets, I always come across a strange picture. I always confront a very strange picture. Namely, what would you say, what is strange about all the stories in Tanakh? Something very strange, which we have all, many times across such pictures, portrayal of situations and despair. You always read, for instance, today, we'll read next Shabbos, the portion of the week. What will you read? A very strange story. The crowd is intoxicated. The community is intoxicated, drunk, and has gone berserk. The crowd is lost in its own confusion. All controls, all checks and controls are gone. All norms ignored. Sense of responsibility abandoned. The crowd is intoxicated. No crowd moves like a sleepwalker, straight forward to a yawning abyss. Disaster is ready to strike. You see the story in Kefiso. Disaster is ready to strike in a matter of seconds. The wrath of the Almighty is about to smite and to destroy the people, its history, past, present, and future. What happens at the 12th hour, or perhaps 1 minute before 20, at the final moment, when the cloud is on the brink of a bottomless, unfathomable abyss? What happens? Who holds the community in its march to physical or spiritual catastrophe? Who stops the community in its mad rush to extermination? One individual, only one individual, is a redeemer, is a prophet, is a priest, is a great teacher. But he is an individual, and nothing but an individual. One lonely man, one lonely man, with not many things. Man's thing has no influence on the people. It is man's subject. One man individual, subject. Man mystery. One clandestine man makes the multitude stop before they all tumble down into the abyss. The individual saves the masses. If not for him, there would be no people. The people, the community, lost its birthright many times. The charismatic, elected individual, who is, if I may coin the expression, a crisis personality, a personality which only he can stand and face crisis. A crisis personality. The chosen individual, the prophet, the redeemer, intervenes and rescues the people. Moses during the eagle episode, during the Meraglim scandal, during Baal-Peor encounter, Eliyahu Bar-Carmel, David, Ezra, the Maccabees, Chachmei Chazal, Rishonim Acharonim, etc., etc. And how beautiful the Midrash speaks. The Pasuk in Vayikra, Ve'av gam zeiz b'yeisam v'eretz eveyam, le'me'astim v'le'ge'altim, le'chaleisam, le'ofer brisi itam, ani ad Hashem v'le'keyam, and yet for all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them, neither will I abhor them, to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. So the Midrash says, V'avgam zeiz b'yeisam b'eretz eveyam lo'i me'astim, b'mei kazdim lechaleisam, V'avgam zeiz b'yeisam b'eretz eveyam lo'i me'astim, b'mei keresh, at a time when Keresh announced that the Jews are free to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash, to return to the homeland. Shemadeti Lehem Ezra. That time there was a man by the name Ezra who organized the return to Zion. V'ligialtim b'mei Chashmonaim. I did not abhor them in the time of the Chashmonaim. Shemadeti Lehem Matisyo Banav. That time there were five people, I mean six people from it. One is five, Matisyo is five sons, who had the courage to declare war at the Greeks or the Hellenized Syriacs. Vilei Lechaleifam Bimei Titus Shemabitalem Rabbi Yechanan Zakai. During the destruction of the second Talmud, there was a personality of Rabbi Yechanan Zakai who saved Yavne and perpetuated Yavis. Interesting is that the Midrash does not state that God's grace asserted itself in that the Jews who were saved from many crises and disasters, like such as the Babylonian exile, the oppression by the Hellenized Syriacs, Or from the Haman conspiracy, the Midrash mentions also the Haman conspiracy. Shemadatalem Mordechai Vesel. But the Midrash mentions the names of the individuals whom the Almighty has assigned the task of helping the people. Why? The mere fact the people were saved is enough to simply to demonstrate that God hasn't forsaken the Jews. Apparently the Midrash wants to emphasize that the great act of mercy and grace asserted itself not only in the fact that the Jews survived, but also in the presence of great leaders, of individuals who could lead the people. Without those individuals, the people would have never survived. The Aish subject plays an important role in Jewish history. I'm inclined to say that in some respect, the Aish subject makes history. Of course, not in the sense of Carlyle and company, I'm very far from it. But he's responsible for history. His role is that of a crisis personality. So, that's Aish subject, the philosophy of Aish subject. However, when you take a look at another document in the Bible, and we find the opposite opinion, the reverse opinion. A few days from tonight, we'll read about the challenge addressed to Esther, loving with the Amalek Levaki Shalamo, to appear before the king and to plead with him for her people. Why is she supposed to sacrifice her life? When Esther sent the word that entry into the inner court will most probably end in death, Mordechai rebuked her and told her to risk her life and to be ready for the supreme sacrifice. He summoned her to try to enter the inner court, even though the danger was obvious and the chances of success very slim. Here already, the Torah demands of the individual, he should sacrifice himself. For whom? For the community. Just the opposite. What the Torah told us about creation of the individual man, about the conclusion of the covenant with individual man, and about the role of the individual during crisis. Just the reverse. The individual means nothing if the destiny of the community is at stake. And next Shabbos we'll read again. Even the great Moses was told by the Almighty, Lech reid kishiches amcho. So the Gemara in Brachos says, go thee down, for thy people that thou broughtest up out of the land of Egypt have dealt corruptly. The Gemara in Brachos remarks, kulul yosatin lo gdulo ane bishvilam, beis eshon isnadam eshe, I have given you distinction only for their sake, not for your sake. You are great, you are illustrious, you are charismatic, you are a prophet, you have inspiration, you are courageous, but only for their sake, not for your own sake. I single thee out only because of them. And at that instance, Chazal say, Nisnadi Meshe, Meshe was excommunicated by an edict of the heavenly court. Meshe excommunicated. Why? What did Meshe do? The answer is he didn't do anything. But something horrible had happened to Meshe. Something which was about to destroy Moshe's position in Jewish history. Namely, what happened to Moshe? What happened to Moshe? He was the people. And the leader loses the people. Loses his greatness. He is excommunicated by the Almighty. This is not a philosophy of non-subject. Non-subject is unique. Non-subject finds the reason for his existence, the raison d'être, in himself. He doesn't need any community. Here the philosophy of non-object, of non-think, comes to expression. I do exist, yes, but for the sake of somebody else. Who is that somebody? Who is that covenantal community? That multitude of slaves who went berserk, who got intoxicated and drunk, and proclaimed, Eilel Echo Yisrael. Yes. What is the opinion of the Hadus about the relationship between individual and community? Tell me, what is it? What is it? What is finally the philosophy of the Hadus? After all, we keep on speaking about the philosophy of the Hadus. And the question of dignity of the individual is a very popular topic nowadays. The answer is, it is a dialectical philosophy. On the one hand, the Hadus says, the individual reigns supreme. The teleology of being is to be found in him. On the other hand, the Hadus says, the community reigns supreme. The teleology of the individual existence is to be found in the community. And that's the way God willed us to think. That's the way God formulated this philosophy in his eternal book, the Torah. Now let us pick up another distinction between non-object and non-subject. And also point into Yahadus what stand Yahadus has taken on that problem. Namely, I said, the logic of non-object, non-thing, of Western man, mother man, is an empirical logic. Its main characteristics is clarity, distinctiveness, and applicability. I would rather say practicality. You know, pragmatism is the philosophy of the United States. Now it's giving ground. It has begun to give ground to some dark metaphysics. But it has been the philosophy of the United States for many, 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 since the times of Peirce and William James, for many, many years. And what does pragmatism say? And pragmatism is the typical philosophy of men object, men thing. What does pragmatism say? What is true? Whatever is useful. I mean, it's a bit primitive, my formula, but in essence, it's exactly the gist of pragmatic philosophy. Whatever is useful, whatever is applicable, whatever is scientifically acceptable, whatever I can utilize, take advantage of this tool. This is the logic of non-object, non-thing. Non-subject logic is an a priori logic, an ideal logic. It's actually not a logic of the mind, but the logic of a will, a strange, mysterious will, which drives me to do things which are unreasonable. The free will will change the human personality. Now the question is as follows. Man-object has developed a rational logic. Man-subject has developed a voluntaristic logic. Man-object consults logic as to one question only, namely, what is useful, what is not useful. Man-subject consults his logos, his logic, is another question, namely, what is right and what is wrong, what should be and what shouldn't be. What is the approach of Yahadus to that problem? an the problem, an empirical logic versus an a priori voluntaristic logic. A logic of facticity against the logic of ideals. A logic of reason, of reasonableness, against the logic of the will, of the free will. Now let us take a look. On the one hand, we have glorified the empirical logic, the logic of the ratio, of the intellect. We have been granted freedom of thinking with all the depth, sweep, penetration, and exactness of advanced methodical research. I am speaking now about Theodor Schwalbe. You know what Theodor Schwalbe means, a lot. What Unitarian is. Unitarian is very, we are engaged in the out, in Unitarian. What's our method? Is it the method of a voluntaristic logic? Or of the precise and exact logic of men objects? In the field of Talmud Torah, we are rationalists. Rationalists from head to toe. Committed to the most modern methods of thought analysis. And I'm not bragging here. And there are many students of mine in the hall could confirm it. We are committed to the most modern methods of thought analysis, thought classification, thought syllogism, conceptual interpretation, definition, and unification, etc., etc. I don't believe that in any branch of science there is more advanced thinking and more precise and exact thinking than in the field of halacha nowadays. The scholar, the Talmud Chacham, enjoys full freedom. No restrictions imposed, no reservations or qualifications limit the creative processes of Talmud Torah. In the halacha, jihadists insisted upon absolute shimto masechel, unlimited, unrestricted rule by the intellect, by the logos. No emotional consideration must interfere with the clear halachic thinking, no prophetic intervention, no voices, no visions, or no secret communications have a place in halachic research and halachic thinking. If I may say so, as far as Torah study is concerned, we have insisted, we still insist, upon intellectual monism and intellectual exclusiveness. The halachic scholar, in many ways, resembles the mathematician who builds his world exclusively of pure intellectual constructs, barring emotional motifs from interfering with his way of thinking. So it means, who rules supreme, who reigns supreme in the field of halacha? The logos, the empirical logos, the precise logos. The logic and the methodology of men thing, men object. Yes. However, if we make an about face, and we turn around to face not the halacha, but Jewish history, Jewish historical experiences, then we are confronted with a situation which is completely different. In matters pertaining
to his total historical destiny. The Jews did not live by their logos, by their intellect, but by a mysterious will. I don't know what name you can coin for the will. James speaks about a will to believe. Biologists speak about a will to survive. I don't know, but the mysterious will by which we lived. We acted, and we are still acting, not in accordance with empirical logic, but in compliance with a secret, mysterious, clandestine will. The Jews have lived by a completely non-empirical set of rules, non-empirical. They postulated rules, and by those postulated rules, they did live. Their historical thinking, their bold thrust, and unqualified total dedication to a mysterious past and an unknown future, their tenacity, their unreasonable tenacity to survive as a spiritual, as a unique spiritual entity. All those things were not the product of strict empirical logic, which recognizes one authority only, namely the majestic, pragmatic, utilitarian logos, ratio. For the empirical logician, there are no absolute norms for which you have to sacrifice your life. Man thinks doesn't know of ultimate norms, because everything for man thinks is relative, interwoven into the fabric of social mores and the social ethos. Norms change, laws are modified, amended, and there is no eternal way of life. That's what men think. But did we live by that logic? No. We are committed to ultimate. We are still committed to absolute norms. We try to swim against the tide. It's very strange. The same people in the field of halacha have preached unlimited intellectualism, unrestricted rationalism. In the field of historical experience and historical living, we are committed to a mysterious will, a certain transcendental power which determined their thinking and told them to defy the whole world. Their system, the establishment, United Nations, and Western civilization. Man thinks, refuses to accept the total commitment, since he is liberal and history-minded. He will acquiesce in the morality embedded in the historical rational experience, moving along with historical metamorphosis. He will never subscribe to a meta historical ethic. The ethic of men think is not nurtured by the idea of relativity. Every norm is placed within the frame of reference of a system. With the structural, socio-economic changes of the system, the norm either gains significance or loses its validity. But our norm is ultimate. In fact, our basic historical decisions, we are still making basic historical decisions, not only the Jews in Eretz Israel, but the Jews in the diaspora as well. Important decisions about relationships between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community, between the Jewish faith and the
in the Christian church basic decisions. And certainly the Orthodox and Orthodox will make basic decisions, but the making of basic historical decisions is not cleared with the practical intellect. Oh no. If the practical intellect had a say about those decisions, he would have acted completely different.
We did not consult the empirical logic prior to our taking on of commitments, absolute commitments. We did not think out rationally the consequences of such obligations we have taken on, and of such commitments which are binding on us. We were seized by violent transcendental powers, by a mysterious will. And we have reached suddenly, abruptly, basic decisions. And we have not engaged in inquiry and thorough examination.
That's exactly what Chazal said about Nasir Nishma. Chazal had built up Nasir Nishma to a crescendo. That the Jews, by saying Nasir Nishma, have achieved the great, great heights. What is so wonderful about Nasir Nishma? What's so wonderful? What's exactly the substance of Nasir Nishma? Why did Chazal consider Nasir Nishma as the central idea of an eternal people? What's the difference in Nasir Nishma and Nishma Venasi? Why is the order so important, so significant? What's the answer? Nasir Nishma means basic decisions are made without consulting, without reason, without empirical logic. Nasir, we commit ourselves, the Nishma, we will inquire later. If the Jews had said, Nishma, Nas, Nishma, then Alter, they would have never accepted Peir et Hasina. Because empirical logic would have given good advice to the Jew. Keep away. We pledged allegiance, for we had a chance to deliberate. We are determined to survive, determined, both, now it's Israel and here, to survive, no matter how high the cost, and no matter how difficult it is to survive as a singular, unique identity. Yes, whose logic was accepted by the Jews? The logic of man thing, of man object, or the logic of man subject? What's the answer? Again the dialectic. Both logics were accepted. In the field of halacha, the logic of man thing, man object. In the field of historical experiences, the logic of man subject, which is no logic at all. And it's interesting, the Medrash, I have to inject some homiletics simply to keep you from falling asleep. Shuvi Ashuranis, Shuvi Vinechazeboch, and the Shulamite answers, Matechazub Ashuranis, Kimchela Samachanaim. Return, O Shulamite. Return, that we may look upon thee. And the Shulamite was a very undisciplined girl. What will you see in the Shulamite that dances between the camps? And the Midrash interprets beautifully. I don't want to quote, it's too long. Yeah. Return, Shulamite, return. I'm just giving you the gist of the Midrashic interpretation. Return, Shulamite, return. To the universal community, to the community of many things. Return, Shulamite, to the community of cosmic men, men object,
enough soaring aloft to the glorious stars on high. Enough indulging in this indescribable inebriation of reality, in that saving madness, it's a Platonic word, in that saving madness, in that ecstasy of I subject, who is both a lover, a mystic, an artist, a genius, a prophet, to whom the world is not just a collection of things and facts and hard facts, but a living, feeling, and questing organism, Shuvi Ashulamis, Return Ashulamai, Venechazabor, and will attempt to understand thee. The Goy has never understood the Jew. He still doesn't understand the Jew. Perhaps now more than ever, you know that. Don't understand the Jew. We'll try, we'll make an honest attempt to understand thee, to rationalize thy commitments, and to bring them in accord with our logic, with empirical logic, with utilitarian pragmatic logic, with the logic of man's subject, man's thing. But what does this wild Shulamite answer? What's her reply? What's her response to that summons, to that challenge, to that invitation? It's pretty reasonable invitation. What is the answer? Matechazuda Shulamites. What can you see in that Shulamite? You'll never appreciate her aspirations. You'll never share her enthusiasm. You'll always fail to grasp her determination, her readiness to sacrifice. You'll never understand her intoxication and great madness. She's kimchila from her room, like a gypsy dancer, and tangled in an interminable mad dance, involved in a mad rush, in an uncontrollable whirl. She's carried willingly into vast boundless spaces to an unknown destination. She couldn't stop dancing, the eternal dance, even if she wanted to. I subject, or here it's not men subject, but here it is woman subject, a woman mystery, Shulamite the clandestine, the enigmatic girl, the eternal dancer, is the hero of the great historical drama, of the Song of Songs. Again, the dialectic of man was turned by the Torah into a historical dialectic of the Jew. And let me ask you another question. Did not Joseph, the old good Joseph, personify that grand dialectic of two logics, one of the organizer, the executive, man of evil, and one of the dreamer, of the visionary, of the prophet, of the inspired personality? On the one hand, he was executive, great executive, prime minister of Egypt. He planned the Egyptian economy. He organized the administrative apparatus. He made Egypt powerful, rich, and influential. As such, he was not man's subject. Man's subject couldn't have done it. He would have ruined it. He was man's object, man's thing. His logic was pragmatical, utilitarian. He was clever, reasonable, precise, and experienced. And he was the best representative of the establishment, of men's thing. On the other hand, he was the Baal HaChalimah. Not only when he was young, and as a tender mind. But also after he had reached maturity, after he had attained prominence and power, he was still the same visionary. You remember, he still was dreaming while he was prime minister. He beheld a glorious vision in which the sun, the moon, the stars were immortal. His soul was inspired, his intellect exalted, his heart afire. He was carried away to an invisible world. He was both man abject and man subject. There was a schism in his personality, of course, a split, a dichotomy. But in the dialectic, in that dichotomy, in that contradiction, he found his greatness. His multicolored shirt was symbolic of his iridescent personality. Now I'm coming to the third and last one. Now the question, and another question now. The third distinction between man object and man subject, between thing and persona, between plane and point, is related to deed and thought. May I use the Talmudic phrase, Heim Ma'ariv, which one is to be preferred? One is to be preferred, noble emotion or deed. I subject says the inwardness in man, in everything. His externality is of secondary significance. I object state the opposite, reverse. The deed counts, the intention, the emotion, the experience is worth it. There is no need to state what is the attitude of Yahadis. There is no need to state the already known and the already familiar. That Yahadis, on the one hand, has embraced the philosophy of men think that the deed counts. Cannot imagine an observant Jew without engaging in action. Action in the halacha is central and indispensable. Without the physical performance, there is no religious observance. The halacha was out and is still out to involve the body in the service of God. Therefore, she singled out physical acts and invested them with religious meaningfulness and purposefulness. The halacha is concerned with the body. On the one hand, the halacha is concerned with the body. The objective it pursues is the redemption of physiological functions which are insensate and meaningless per se, and their elevation to the great height of service and meaningfulness. The halacha places great emphasis, just like the man think, like the executive, like the banker, like the manager in a production plant, great emphasis upon the detail. Detail in the halacha is very important. The minutiae are not something to be contemptuously ignored and brushed aside. Non-compliance with a minor detail
quite often render the whole performance worthless. For instance, let us take a few examples. A beautiful effort on the first day of Sukkot, which has been punctured just by a needle. I don't want to get involved in the halachos now. But in order to emphasize, I use the paradoxality of the situation, I use the term needle. But being punctured is disqualified. If I should hold it, my act will not be rewarded at all. Because one detail, which is almost invisible to the eye, is certainly invisible to the untrained eye, is missing. An ardent prayer, no matter how zealously and warmly one should pray, an ardent prayer flowing from the depth of the heart, saturated with zeal and fervor, will be considered worthless. If disaster, in quotation marks, should strike, and one should omit two words, the same Talmud. Again, prima facie, this Talmud is not so important in order that it could invalidate the prayer, or render it void and null, that it does. It does, you know very well, if you meet a Talmud, tonight you have to repeat it yourself. If sunset, for instance, on Friday is at 6:05, a person doing work at 6 o'clock, I'm not advising that method, I'm not advising you to follow that, but I'm speaking in terms of theoretical halacha. A person doing work 5 minutes prior to that time, he's within his right, and his action is not culpable. While engagement in the same work 5 minutes later would involve the person in culpability of grave consequences. Basically, the halacha has adopted a mathematical, scientific approach. Indeed, there is halachic mathematics. There are numbers and measurements with which the halacha is concerned. You know what I mean? The halacha quantifies objects. Like the scientific method since the days of Galileo and Newton. People, of course, our enemies, have accused us of pedantry, of giving undue attention to details. Isn't the scientist a pedant? Isn't the engineer concerned with every minute detail, which to the uninitiated eye appears to be insignificant? A pedant? Isn't the whole cosmic order created by God based on pedantry and pedantry? The image, so is the halacha. The image of man-thing, who as an executive is preoccupied with small things, is projected by the halacha. We have accepted the precision and the concern for detail from the main thing, and we have announced, we concur with him, that action is central and indispensable. Because the halacha basically is a system of divine disciplines. And through disciplined action, man rises above the beast and the brute. And of course, there cannot be disciplined action unless the detail is given its due. And the detail One gives attention to the other one. Right, now let us see the reverse of it. But Yahadus is not only a system of divine disciplines, which exhaust themselves only in action. On the other hand, Yahadus is also a romance. A romance between God and the Jew. A romance between God and man. An adventure. A quest.
A cleansing and cathartic experience. A steady movement. And if you will, as the Rambam said, she going rid of it, a great madness. A madness from which we cannot free ourselves.
There are mitzvahs in our halachic system that relate not to action, but to the innermost demand,
to his emotional life, to man's deeps and recesses unknown even to himself. Our enemies say, the halacha, with its pedantry, with its undue attention given to detail, shuts out the vision of God. It is unjust and it's unfounded. The experience plays a central role in our worldview. We serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu with our minds, with our hands, and also with our hearts. While the mind and the hand, thought and action, are disciplined, precision, and detail, are indispensable, our hearts are undisciplined, and are overflowing with a great passionate love, which sweeps away all boundaries and inundates, and which inundates all environs. The divine disciplines inspire us rather, is an inspiration rather than a handicap to the person in his quest for God. I gave you, for instance, the example of tefillah, how a small detail may invalidate prayer. But tefillah is identical with God, on the other hand. His God-man confrontation. Indeed, it's a dialogue. Talmud Torah, regardless of the intellectual precision and exactness, it requires, is at the same time a mystical rendezvous between the Shechina and the student. Simche, Yom Tov, for instance, is tantamount to Lifnei Hashem, to experiencing the divine quest, the slowing down of our feverish mental time, to experiencing a sense of heightened significance and purposiveness. The man begins to feel the presence of the Almighty in every event, in everything, in the roaring tide, and in the small pebble on the beach, in the beam of light penetrating through the cracks of the blind every morning in our bedroom, and in the movement of one's index finger. That's what the Hadith has recommended, to experience God, not only in the starry skies. Oh no, in the starry skies many may experience God, in the uncharted spaces, in the dark uncharted spaces, in the billions of stars, many can experience God. The Jew is capable to experience God also in living things, in the sand on the beach, and in the pebbles, and the rolling tide, in the flowering tree, and in the movements of my own muscles, of one's muscles. The high subject has not been rejected. The metaphysical dialectic was translated into halachic dialectics. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wins man in general, and Jew in particular, to engage in both. In both. in action and in thought, in deed and in emotion, in accomplishment and in experience. To say, finally how this is out, to reconcile the opposite. Reconciliation will not take place now. It will take place, you know when? On that day, by Yemahu, on that day. A day is slowly coming, but it is coming. Sooner or later, the day will arrive. Then by dear men, we will reconcile. Think good with personality, subject with object, logic of the will, with logic of the intellect. Deed with thought, action with experience. Eise sholim bimremo, uyase sholim aleinu, ve'akol Yisrael. It's a very strange phrase we pronounce every time when we step backwards after concluding the Shemesre. What kind is Yaseh Sholem Bimreinu? What's Yaseh Sholem Aleinu? So Chazal saying in Rosh Hashanah, Yaseh Sholem Bimreinu, between whom and whom does God make peace? So the answer which was given by Chazal was, Bimechoel HaGavriel, between the archangel Michael and the archangel Gabriel. Why do they quarrel? Why do they engage in controversy? Why are they involved in a feud? The answer is, the angel is not like man. The angel is a monistic being. There is no schism in the angel. There is no split in the angel. The angel is a harmonious being. The angel represents only one midah, one attribute of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mechoel represents the attribute of chesed, of loving kindness, of mercy, of forgiveness, of compassion. Gabriel represents the opposite midah, the opposite attribute, divine attribute, namely gvura, din, justice, strictness, punishment, and sometimes retribution. Of course, there is the dichotomy, there is the endless distance separating Mechoel from Gabriel. Chesed, love from kindness. Mercy from retribution. And warmth from strictness. But in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there is no antithesis. There is no dichotomy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was called by the medieval philosophers coincidentia oppositorum. In him, all opposites are reconciled. In him, all contradictions are resolved. In him, thesis and antithesis merge into one. In him, there is only harmony and shalom. So we, concluding Shemesri and stepping backwards, we pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that that day, that eschatological day may arrive, that man will achieve harmony. Duality will disappear, and man will act. Man himself will become a coincidentia oppositorum. Eise sholem bimreinu. In the same manner as there is coincidentia oppositorum, or in Hebrew, mizuk amides, in heaven, above, and high, there should be mizuk amides, the reconciliation of opposites, and earth below. Eise sholem bimreinu, uyase sholem aleinu, v'al kol Yisrael. And any plot. then isn't the Shabbos a Shabbos? The symbol of that great cosmic harmony, of coincidentia oppositorum, of reconciliation, of the opposites. In the evening, it's quite interesting. In the evening, we offer a prayer, Ato kedashtus im ashvi nishmecho, tachlis nase shamayim varet. Vaychu ha shamayim varet v'chol tzvar. Man is not mentioned at all. Is man mentioned in the evening prayer of Shabbos? What do you say? Not mentioned. Ha shamayim v'yoret v'chol tzvar. The earth and the heavens, with all their hosts. And man is a part of the host. He's a thing. He's a little particle in the cosmic process of creation. He's just an integral, infinitesimal particle, rather. Friday night, man appears, emerges as man think, interrelated, and with other phenomena, enmeshed in the cosmic order, man thing. But man thing was created by God. Saturday morning, the whole melody or the tune changes. The whole background is transformed. About whom do we speak Saturday morning? About the great individual. About Moses, the greatest of all. I subject, unique, singular, not the thing anymore. Free, bold. Who embraces infinity itself. Yismach Meishav and not Nostalgia. Shomayim, the astral world, words, nature, has little meaning in comparison with the great individual. In the morning, I subject emerges. The individual whose dignity is to be found not in the system, but in himself. And for Mincha, what do you say? Ato echot, v'shimcho echot. You are one, as the Rambam says. He is one because in God there is subject and object, and there is no contradiction. God is one, because in God there is mercy and strictness. There is chesed and rachamim on the one hand, and din and gvura on the other hand, and there is no contradiction. He is the coincidentia oppositorum. Ato echad, because in thee we find hei dinetzach, beauty which is passing, transient, ephemeral, and netzach eternity itself. Stop it with him. You are the one. And your Torah, which was entrusted to us, to what destination does that Torah lead us? To what destination? Mikam Cho Yisrael. Gilechot Boaz. That split, that season should disappear. And then Shabbos will be Ayin Minucho Grisho Me'am Cho Yisrael.